You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for March 22nd, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the George W. Bush Square in beautiful downtown Baghdad, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Back in 2003, they were going to build a square that was going to be named after W.
Yeah, it was. Richard Pearl said he predicted that and said, after this, remember, this was September 2003, Blue Gal, after we had won in Iraq.
After we mission had accomplished.
After every neocon was busy walking around the block doing their strut, going, well, I guess all the liberals are wrong then. I guess it's all over then, isn't it? How about you all just shut the fuck up for the next 20 years about foreign policy, you loser, French-loving, surrender monkey assholes. Richard Pearl said, a year from now, I'd be very surprised if there's not some grand square in Baghdad that's named after President Bush. I'm sure there's a lot of things in Baghdad named after President Bush. I would very much doubt that any of them don't involve defecation or urination.
And what is Richard Pearl doing today?
Well, the disgraced and humiliated Richard Pearl, along with Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney and Michael Hanlon and David Brooks and the rest of the war criminals and enablers that lied us into Iraq, all have been cast from public view, driven in, back into the caves, and no one's ever heard from them again.
No, that's not true. That's not Richard happened. Pearl was on NPR this week.
Richard Pearl was on a couple of places, including NPR. The nice, polite Republicans had him on the air to talk about foreign policy.
And we want to hat tip the listener that brought that to our attention. Yeah.
Yep. And Paul Wolfowitz was invited on former neocon, current CNN host Fareed Zakaria's show to talk about his expertise in foreign policy. Michael O'Hanlon was on MSNBC talking about Iraq, and Dick Cheney was everywhere, and David Brooks
they've made a documentary about Dick Cheney. Yeah.
Yeah, but he was everywhere. He's everywhere. And the person I'm not going to get into too much because of my Lenten promise has not mentioned Iraq once. At all.
Oh, that's ever. Interesting.
Talks about the progressives and how the progressive caucus and progressives don't understand economics. One of the many, many things David Brooks doesn't understand is math.
Yeah.
And so he opines freely on that.
So he has taken some sort of Lenten promise not to talk about Iraq, huh?
Yes, yes.
That's interesting.
As opposed to his credit, Andrew Sullivan is reprinting some of his more outrageous columns from 2003. And
is he doing that in order to atone?
He's half atoning.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to two-toning, he's half-toning. So, yeah, he's republishing them all with, look, I was wrong. There's blood on my hands. I screwed up. But they're always tinged with that little left hook at the very end that I was misled by the competence and brilliant management style and overwhelming evidence and that the Bush administration presented. And as Digby pointed out, I am unfamiliar with that particular manifestation of the Bush administration. He always struck me as childlike and barely sentient. Hey, mistakes were made. People made errors. And you know what? That's true. I have considerably less ire for people who were just lied into this, who fell for.
Well, and I want to apologize too, because I did say to my then husband at the time, you know, the New York Times says Secretary Powell has made a significant and believable case for war.
Yep.
And I said, I guess I remember saying to my now ex, I guess we have to go with that. And I was so wrong.
Yeah.
But I, like a lot of other people, did not realize the conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And quickly thereafter, you know, we all came around and realized, oh my God, this was just.
They were just as fucking evil and incompetent.
Just a lie.
And they
lied to by the New York Times, by the administration, by lots of people.
Well, that was what was so insidious and powerful and long-term destructive. Mm-hmm. Because every institution that we normally turn to for unbiased opinion making or people who we can generally trust. You know, there's a certain amount of science involved in persuading people. And one of the most powerful persuasive techniques is trust and authority.
Yeah.
Someone you know whose opinion you trust. You know, I was that guy for lots of people in various workplaces. I was the person who followed politics. I was the person who read up to page 13 on stories.
Yeah.
And so people came and asked not what they should think, but what did I think about this or that? And that was a role I was happy to play in various places. But the Bush administration so methodically undermined trusted institutions and infiltrated attorney-client privilege, infiltrated the press, infiltrated the faith-based organizations, and turned them all into mechanisms for advancing the neoconservative agenda. And then hid behind, well, I can't tell you who my sources are because I'm a reporter. Well, I can't tell you what went on because it's top secret. Well, I can't tell you because it's attorney-client privilege. And then we find out, oh, you used all of that, all of the little places in government and in culture where you're allowed to be private.
Yeah.
You used every one of those to conspire to fuck us over and to take us to war on completely false pretenses. The idea that the government of the United States would do that on purpose shouldn't have come as a shock to anybody.
Yeah.
But the idea that it was done, that you had Vietnam plus Watergate plus done on purpose.
Oh, yeah.
And that the worst terrorist attack in American history was
Iran-Contra
hijacked.
Yep.
You know, nothing was hijacked to make Iran-Contra happen.
Yeah.
But the worst, most tragic event in
except for votes by Congress. They were hijacked and just ignored. Yeah. But, I got to talk to you about my dream last night, Driftglass. It's weighing heavily on me.
Okay. Please do.
I'm gonna interrupt you.
Please, no, go ahead.
I had a dream last night, Driftglass.
Yes.
About Tom Brokaw.
Oh, no.
I know.
Oh, no.
There was some kind of church meeting going on in our dining room.
Uh-huh.
And I was in the kitchen baking a German chocolate cake from a mix, and I was using a bowl that was too small, and it fell off the counter. You know where we keep that, right behind where the cat dishes are?
I do.
It fell right there by that window.
Uh-huh.
And then I turned around. Somebody said, oh, it's going to be okay. Just pick it up and we'll put more eggs in and mix it again. And I was mixing the frosting in with the cake for some reason. And the person telling me it was going to be okay was Tom Brokaw.
Wow.
And the meeting had already started, and the cake wasn't even in the oven yet, and I knew it wasn't going to be done, and I knew it was going to taste terrible, and I knew everything about it was going to be wrong.
Uh-huh.
But Tom Brokaw was there telling me everything was going to be fine.
Don't worry, Blue Gal. Everything's going to be fine. Just throw a bunch of crap in a bag and put it in the oven. It's going to be fine. Wow. Okay, Tom Brokaw. Gee, I wonder what that has anything to do with. First of all,
I don't. Yeah, you want to interpret my dream for me, Driftglass?
Not for all the money that you and I have in both of our pockets. I will say that sometimes a Brokaw is just a Brokaw.
Yeah.
Something about the what was it? The Pottery Barn. You break it, you bought it. You know, something about the Pottery Barn analogy that Colin Powell allegedly used about once you go into this country and break it, it's yours. And
someone left my Tom Brokaw cake in the rain.
Yes, someone left.
Think
yes,
that I can take it.
Yeah.
All right. I don't have long enough to bake it. But all right.
The idea that Tom Brokaw would come along and look at something that was clearly a disaster.
And yeah,
it'll be fine. It'll be fine.
Westwood, and that's, everything that, will be fine.
But and that's you know, this is 10 years later. This is 10 years later. And the idea that all of these people are still present.
Yeah.
And unaccountable.
Have valid platforms on which to speak about foreign policy. And, absolutely.
And I just want to finish up this one thing without interrupting, which, you know, I do all the time. I have much more sympathy for someone who was who trusted and was lied into something than I do for someone who deliberately lied them into it. I also have much less sympathy for people who made a bad decision based on lies, mm-hmm. and then said, okay, that's what we're going to do. I have a lot more sympathy for those people than the people who then turned and said, and if you disagree with me, I'm going to rip your throat out.
Yeah, or you're a cheese-eating surrender monkey.
You're a traitor.
Not a true American. Yeah.
I have especially hard time forgiving people who, once the tables turned, mm-hmm. suddenly started, hey, let's say, oh, well, let's all be cool, man.
Yeah.
Everybody be cool, you know, hey, suddenly it's all about Burke and reticence and modesty, and let's not say things we might regret at some point.
Now, you can't say that and pretend that you're not breaking your Lenten promise.
I'm not. That is the typical pure conservative approach. You should be modest in your opinions. You should be careful in how you say things. You should be cautious about making any radical changes, all of which were freely violated in the run-up to an execution and the botching of the Iraq War.
Well, the meme right now, though, Driftglass, is two-part. One is it was well executed and it was a really, really good thing to do. It was just based on bad intelligence.
Yep.
I've read three conservative blog posts right along those lines this week. And then you go to the common threads of those posts and they said, yeah, and we all know that the weapons of mass destruction are in Syria.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's not bad intelligence because the WMDs are there all along.
Yeah.
It's just that Saddam Hussein was really good at hidey.
And if you permit, and this is something I can't control, you can't control, and it's incredibly frustrating to watch. But the same people who completely abandoned their ideological principles about reticence and modesty in order to kick the shit out of liberals.
Yep.
Now are the people who said, hey, let's everybody get along. Let's not get crazy. Let's not make people actually suffer career-wise.
Right.
The irony, of
you
course.
Know what? You don't get anybody fired over this, right?
And, well, the irony that Andrew Sullivan really, really is furious that Bill Kristol hasn't suffered any sort of blowback from being horribly wrong and a liar and a douchebag.
He hasn't suffered anything for all of his Maggie Thatcher cheerleading.
Andrew Sullivan has never missed a meal as he transitioned from a friend of Donald Rumsfeld, which he freely admits to, which he mentions, to a person who gets invited to Barack Obama's White House.
You're listening to the Professional Left Podcast, professionalleft.blogspot.com. I do have a serious question about Obamacare.
Of course.
Do you think that Obamacare has been set up as it's been set up for the, you know, private insurance, people will buy private insurance and so forth. Has that been set up to fail? The reason I ask is that I found out a couple of weeks ago, and we didn't have time to talk about it last week, that this high risk pool that they created for people to pay for insurance if they had cancer and couldn't get insurance, you could buy into the high risk pool and actually pay for insurance and get insurance. And what they discovered is that, you know, half the people that they thought would sign up for this didn't sign up for it because they couldn't afford it.
Uh-huh.
And the other half, the program ran out of money, that they're just, you know, it's too expensive to take care of people who already have cancer. It's just expensive.
It just is. Yes.
And if it's not fully funded and it's not, there is no pool beyond the high risk candidates, they're not insurable in that market sense. You have to put them on Medicaid. I mean, that's it.
Well, let me.
So I'm wondering about Obamacare in that regard, that you're going to have anyone who is paying for insurance, you know, the people that are not low income. And it looks like, you know, the middle class is disappearing so quickly that lots and lots of people that they don't think would ordinarily be eligible for Medicaid are going to be eligible just because incomes of the middle class are dropping.
Because that's the plan.
But maybe that's the plan. That's what I'm wondering. And then you have this huge constituency for Medicaid, which, of course, is what the Republican Party, I think, is really afraid of.
Yeah. And well, they should
then
be.
So there will be a lot of bitching, I guarantee you, from people that are having to go to these exchanges to actually buy coverage. Because they can't keep prices low if they're not going to deal with big pharma and hospitals and what these things cost. As we know from this article in Time magazine that everybody's been talking about, they're doing nothing on the cost side, really, to deal with particularly the cost of pharmaceuticals. It's just, it's going to run out of money and then it fails and then you've got to do something else.
I don't know that it's as Machiavellian as that. However, may I offer a couple of observations and opinions?
Yes.
The first is that the reason the Koch brothers spent $1 jillion for the last 30 years is to change the terms of the debate. They lose a lot. They lose candidates, but they just keep pumping money into it because they want to change the discussion from how can we get government to best serve the people, to how can we cut taxes as deeply as possible. They want to change the discussion away from in the middle of this economic malaise, downfall, restructuring, whatever you want to call it, completely away from jobs and people getting jobs so they can pay their bills and buy things and keep a roof over their head, to look at these awful, awful deficits. We need to cut everything right now as deeply as possible. And they've largely won that discussion.
Yeah, they have. They have. Chris, they certainly won that discussion among the Beltway media, who now are all millionaires.
They absolutely have. And the discussion is now, and this was getting back to, I will touch lightly on Mr. Brooks's column, was entirely about how those crazy liberals think that you can just throw government money at jobs, at hiring people, and that will somehow solve the problem of the economy. That they don't understand that, you know, blah, 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 wealth producers and yada, 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 and Rand and so forth. If you can't solve the problem of unemployment by having a perpetual make work project with the government, where the government employs most of the people, because eventually you do run out of revenue to tax to create those jobs. However, teachers aren't a make work job. Building bridges are not make work jobs.
Repairing bridges is not make work.
They're
exactly.
Jobs. And the idea that you would have this historic low interest rate on borrowed money go to waste because the conversation, they refuse to have a conversation about jobs, and we're just going to focus on debt and deficit, even though 10 years ago, none of these people gave a shit about deficits. And the minute a Republican gets in the White House, they will stop giving a shit about deficits again. Mm-hmm. They don't care about it. It's a way to get rid of the federal government.
Well, they were campaigning, and the Ryan budget is full of deficits. And Romney campaigned on a 20% across-the-board tax cut, which was going to create huge deficits.
Well,
so while they're complaining about deficits, they're going ahead and their exact proposals are for more deficits.
Well, yeah, but what they say is the supply side fairy will come and make jobs happen, which everyone knows is nonsense. We had a 30-year experiment with that. It's a complete, utter failure on the scale that Iraq is a complete and utter failure. Nobody in their right mind still believes that. But the people who control our
public— I don't think anyone ever believed that. George H.W. Bush never believed that.
No, but—
The experiment was, we're going to do this anyway, even though we know it won't work. Because it benefits us financially.
Well, it gets to people who hate government, who hate the idea of government, who hate the idea. And this is all wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Yeah. This isn't really about WMDs. This is about decapitating regimes and getting rid of, you know, the American rewriting the map of the Middle East. That's in a way that's friendly to us and friendly to our oil friends. But we're going to say it's about WMDs because that's the only way you'll let us do this shit. We're going to say this is about deficits, but this has nothing to do with deficits. This has to do with rolling back what we believe are these horrible programs called the New Deal and basically back to the Enlightenment. We want to get rid of all those programs. We think that the Great Depression was a disaster in that we were saved from becoming a feudal society with plutocrats at the top and everyone else at the bottom, because that's what we want. So we want to engineer one crisis after another that will plunge us back into that and continue to have a conversation about how do we cut more. Let's talk about welfare queens. Let's talk about cheats. Let's talk about shiftless people. Let's talk about 47%. And we're not going to talk about jobs in the middle class. And this is what drives, I know, people like Chris Hayes crazy, because that's what we should be talking about. That, and this, again, this is a conversation about healthcare.
Yeah.
So the Kochs have spent, and their cronies have spent billions and billions of dollars to change the subject, to make sure that TV networks will not talk about the shit liberals want to talk about, that the people who run television networks dare not put real liberals on the air.
Or poor people
who really are like you and me, people who are like 90% of America, never get on television because they might raise really uncomfortable topics like, this isn't the country I was born in. I don't mean that black people are now running the White House.
I have done everything right. I got married before I had kids. I went to college. I did this, and I cannot pay my bills.
And I have nothing. And I have no prospect of ever getting anything ever again. And I don't know what the hell happened to my country, except a whole lot of people are getting really rich and there's nothing left for anyone else.
Right.
Why is that okay with you? And why is cutting the only source of wealth redistribution or mobility making or the only institution that can possibly help me out of this trough that I am in. Why are you all about cutting that as deeply as possible and keeping me down as far as possible and selling me this bullshit about the American dream?
And why did 10 Democrats vote against increasing the minimum wage? Why is that? Yeah,
that's the conversation we should be having. But
yeah,
but the money was spent and well spent to make sure that's never the conversation.
Yep.
So here's the thing. Your conversation about healthcare is about what will happen to those uninsured people when X happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think the lasting legacy of Obamacare, whether it survives in its current form or not, I doubt it will, is that it has established a beachhead in the sense that the conversation is now, what are we going to do about these people if this fails?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now it's no longer acceptable to say, fuck them, let them die.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Now we have to have a conversation about, okay, well, since your free market solution failed, now what do we do?
Now what do we do? Yeah.
And that will continue to be the conversation as long as there is this thing on the books called Obamacare, as long as the Supreme Court said, it's cool with us, as long as Republicans keep voting against it and failing, and as long as people keep getting older and sick.
And people all of a sudden have coverage that didn't have coverage before, and then you're taking something away from someone, which is what happened with Medicare and what happened with Social Security.
Yeah.
Alex Wagner on MSNBC made the point that the advantage that the House Progressive Budget has is that it has things in it that people actually like. And that's the case, you know, job creation, Social Security, Medicare, investment in infrastructure are things that people are for. So we are recording. We are back and we're recording Friday morning.
Yes.
For the next 20 minutes or so.
Or 2 hours.
I have found myself, as people have talked about the death of the Tea Party this week. And remember, there is no Tea Party. It is simply
trademark.
George Bush Republicans, George W. Bush Republicans who burned their uniforms.
Yes.
But I have, as that discussion has been going on, I have found myself actually jealous of Tea Party Republicans this week because they seem to have their Congress by the short hairs.
They do.
And their Congress will do whatever they want. Now, the only thing their Congress can't do is govern. So that changes everything.
Well, no, they do govern. They govern by obstruction.
Yeah.
If your predicate is all government is bad, government must be destroyed at any cost.
And we must stop Barack Obama no matter what.
Yeah. And no matter what the subject is, whether it's foreign policy or military intervention or debt or deficit, we're going to find a way to hang our particular ornament from that tree.
Mm-hmm.
Because ultimately, we don't give a shit about any of that stuff, really. What we care about is crashing the federal government, getting rid of it, going back to the Articles of Confederation, and devolving power back to the states.
But I don't want to talk about them today. I want to talk about me.
Well, I want you to talk about you too. But the point being, there's a different if your goal is to obstruct and destroy something.
You can govern that way.
You can absolutely do that with a minority.
I understand that. I understand that. That said, those of us who are progressive don't want to obstruct. We want to get things done. We want to pass jobs bills.
Yes.
And I got a letter this week and just sighed heavily because I knew what was inside of it, because the outside envelope, maybe some of our listeners got this too. Senator Tammy Baldwin, Democratic headquarters, it says on the outside of this blue envelope. And I'm obviously on the list of people that you hit up for money for Democratic causes, and that's all fine. But this is from the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. And along with the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, these are people that I just hate. Even though I love Tammy Baldwin, and you know, they obviously tailored this very carefully, because it's Tammy Baldwin on the outside who is, let's face it, she's a member of the Progressive Caucus. So she's somebody that I would be more likely to listen to than
If
this came from Joe Lieberman or if this came from you know, back when he was a quote unquote Democrat.
Yeah.
If this came from any of the blue dogs. But, you know, it's a fundraising letter and I'm not going to read it. But And I would never respond to this. I mean, I don't believe, because I believe sincerely that these campaign committees, first of all, they are a time suck for members of Congress who have to raise money for these committees. New congressmen have to spend half their time raising money for these committees.
Yeah.
And the idea that your job is to elect a Democrat, no matter what they stand for. And I mentioned yesterday, you know, 10 Democrats voted against the increase in a minimum wage. Now, in my personal opinion, those 10 Democrats should be driven from the party.
Yep.
They should be have a primary challenge immediately. But no, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has, I think, this was from America Blog. I think they had six out of the, I want to say six, maybe it was eight. I don't know. There was a large percentage of these Democrats who had voted against the minimum wage increase who were on the extra help list of we're going to give them extra money to get reelected.
I think you mentioned that yesterday.
Yeah. And this idea that, okay, the reason they're voting against the minimum wage increase is because they're not in safe seats and they have to vote as conservatively as they possibly can.
Yeah.
But they're Democrats. And it does get to the point where I agree with a lot of our listeners who say, look, if you're going to have a Republican in Congress, have a Republican in Congress.
Yep.
You know, don't call it a Democrat and pretend that that means something when they're voting against minimum wage increase. That doesn't do anybody any good.
Or one congressional district north of us who the Democratic candidate prominently ran her banner, her face page for her campaign and her website is all about personhood.
Yeah. Oh, all about anti-abortion. Yeah. 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 And she was the Democratic candidate. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that is all true. Everything you just said.
Well, and I want to add one more. I want to add one more egg to that cake batter.
Okay. That dream really haunts you, doesn't it, Blue Guy?
God, it's just bothering me so much that I had that dream. Anyway, money. I want to talk about money also and how, because here is this letter is asking for a check, right? And I'm not going to give any congressional or senatorial campaign committee money to elect Blanche Lincoln to the Senate, you know, where she's going to filibuster single payer. Sorry, not going to go there.
First problem is we're broke.
Well, first problem is we're broke. Second problem is this money is not going to further causes that I believe in. It's going to further getting Democrats, quote unquote, reelected, which is not really my interest. My interest is in issues.
Right.
And it's nice that Tammy Baldwin makes a case for there was one section in this letter that caught my eye where she says we want to take action to combat climate change. But she doesn't mention the XL pipeline at all in this whole letter. You know, that might just go through with Democrats in charge. So I'd rather give my money to if I had any money to give, you know, to stopping the XL pipeline, because that matters to me. But it does seem to me, and this is what I want to talk to you about. Number one is we do have to do something about House Republicans. We do have to do something to stop them. And I'm jealous of the fact that not only do Republicans have this crazy wing that apparently runs things, but that crazy wing has lots and lots of funding.
Yeah.
Because the crazy wing actually furthers the interests of the plutocrats. So they're happy, you know, the Koch brothers are happy to fund Tea Party candidates and happy to have primary challenges to people who will not vote as friendly a way to their interests. And then you get to, but going in that direction, I wish that the Democratic Party was afraid of voters like me. And we don't have that kind of funding stream to do that. I don't like money in politics the way it is. And yet then we had a talk. Remember back at the Heartland Cafe with an activist who was talking about he was allowed to sit in as a reporter on congressional training. And they actually had some lobbyist speaking before these Democratic new Congress people.
Yeah.
And people sat and listened and clapped politely and, you know, listened to these speakers. And then somebody from Move On stood up and all the yellow notepads came out because money.
Yeah.
Yep. And it was depressing to this person and depressing to all of us listening to him. That
I was in D.C. Mm-hmm. On business back when I went to D.C. on business. During the depths of the Bush administration.
Yeah.
And I was meeting with lobbyists who were hired by the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. who were giving us all kinds of good advice and all kinds of insight, and then just gritted his teeth and cringed and said, now I have to go meet with Tom DeLay.
Yeah.
And one lobbyist at this lunch, a different one completely, but at a luncheon, stood up and essentially repeated every Republican talking point. If you want to get anything done in Washington now, you have to really phrase it in kind of an economic, growth, entrepreneur, et cetera, et cetera. Here's your new vocabulary. And if you want to get anything done, because now we run everything, mm-hmm. here's how you're going to have to change your message and change your belief. And then he added, of course, I'm a lawyer and a lobbyist, so if you pay me, I'll say the exact opposite of what I just said.
Wow.
And everyone laughed because, yeah. you know, that's,
yeah.
that's
yeah.
the game. Yeah. But if you think of the economy, this is a bad analogy, I know. But I want to go right back to your discussion of how to do this.
Yeah, because I want to talk about what we do. How do we approach this?
Think of the economy as a munitions factory. Mm-hmm. And you think of the recovery that we are going through, 121% of the output of that economy has gone to people who don't like us.
Yeah. Yeah.
And everyone else is broke or getting broker or flatlined, and virtually every penny of the stock market boom and the quote unquote recovery has gone to the top 1%.
Yeah, it's gone to Mitt Romney. Yeah,
and yeah. guess where that money gets plowed back into when it comes to politics?
Yep.
It comes to paying people to those people. I don't want to paint them with too broad a brush because there are plenty of rich Democrats. There are plenty of rich liberals out there. But their interest is in cutting everything and deregulating everything. Mm-hmm. And there's always a market for that. There's a libertarian think tank in Chicago that is all over the media, all over the press. American Heritage Foundation, but I'm sure I got that right. It's Heritage Foundation.
Heritage Foundation, yeah.
Was a tobacco lobbying
yep.
shop.
Yep.
Back when tobacco money was big, and then they become an oil lobbying shop. Now, but it's always the same libertarian argument that this isn't about tobacco or oil. It's about freedom.
Freedom, yes. And it'll be big pharma next. And it'll freedom to have the drugs you need at the time you need them. And
I guarantee you, a couple of people who work there might very well go right on writing letters and writing white papers in their basement once the money dries up. But the minute someone stops writing checks from those industries,
yeah.
those shops shut down.
Oh, yeah. And you and I have talked about Sean Hannity the same way. If yeah. somebody paid him three times as much to go be a liberal on MSNBC, he'd do it in a heartbeat.
So what do you do?
What do you do as a progressive
right.
who wants to see things get done?
Uh-huh.
And I know that, you know, things take time, and part of what we've been taught is patience. However, it doesn't seem like the right wing crazies have to worry about that.
No. Well, may I quote back to you one thing you said and then ask you to talk about it a little bit more?
Okay.
You said you care about, you're not going to send this woman money because you care about progressive issues.
Mm-hmm.
You use the plural. You care about issues.
Yeah.
You care about lots of different things.
Yeah.
You care about feeding people. You care about having people
education.
Have healthcare, education,
yep.
et cetera, et cetera. That puts you at a distinct disadvantage
mm-hmm.
over someone who only cares about
winning.
Person,
yeah.
Only
yeah.
cares about cutting federal regulation. Yeah. Only cares about getting those goddamn welfare cheats.
Well, and if Barack Obama came out tomorrow wanting to cut a certain regulation, I mean, this was the thing that got me yesterday about David Vitter David Vitter standing up and bitching about the EPA not being transparent enough.
Yeah.
And that was his thing, was, look at this, the EPA is hiding something.
Yeah.
And he wants more sunlight thrown on the EPA, because I'm all about government transparency, except when it comes to my oil friends and them meeting with Dick Cheney. That's nobody's business.
Right.
So if Barack Obama comes out for fewer regulations and less government red tape for X, Y, and Z, the right is going to come out and say, well, that's because he wants illegal immigrants to get it.
Right. I write all of the right off, because there's just no. Okay. But you're talking about Blue Dogs.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
And this is.
But Blue Dogs don't get elected if they aren't this way, apparently. That's the conventional wisdom.
Yeah. I don't know how true that is. But,
well, it's the conventional wisdom that the Democratic Party has obeyed all along.
And no one's gonna listen to me or you or Howard Dean saying that, no, this isn't true. Actually, we should just be much more aggressive and push our message. But what do you do if you care about immigration reform, mm-hmm. real immigration reform? Mm-hmm. And someone says, yeah, I'm for immigration reform, but I'm also against assault weapons ban. Mm-hmm. That's my price. Mm-hmm. Don't make me vote on an assault weapons ban, and you can have my vote on immigration reform.
Yeah, and that's the game. That's how it's played.
What do you do?
Yeah.
What I mean, you can sit on your high horse, as I often do, and say, I am too pure to get involved in the mucking about of petty partisan politics and vote trading and all the awfulness that has been going on at the heart of politics since fucking Greece.
Yep.
That's how politics works. And I don't like it. You don't like it. I don't know anybody who does like it. Mm-hmm. I know people who get rich off of it, mm-hmm. but that's, as the man said, if you don't take an interest in politics, politics will definitely take an interest in you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So other than saying, I'm sorry, they're all a bunch of filthy scoundrels and I will have no part of it, which is a very tempting and a completely understandable reaction to mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. What do you do? Assuming that isn't your posture, and there are plenty of people who've just opted out in the sense that one strike and you're out.
Well, one of the things that I've done to keep my sanity and feel like I'm doing the right thing and I can look at myself in the mirror in the morning is to do what you've said to do about Green Party voting. I go local.
Yeah.
So instead of giving to the Senate campaign committee, I give to the food bank.
Yeah.
And I give to, you know, we clean out our pantry fairly often and take stuff over to the food pantry. And I give money to Habitat for Humanity here in town, because I see the houses that are being built and they have signs in front of them. And I know the people who are bringing casseroles to the workers at Habitat for Humanity. You and I have given money, $10 or so, to the local American Cancer Society people who actually drive people to their chemo appointments, you know. Yeah. And when you know that those kind of things are happening and you know your money is going to, and like you said, I said, you and I don't have a lot of money to give to charity in any respect.
But
when we give, I know the money that I give in those local situations
are going.
It's going to go to direct services.
And I can go to the place where they're spending it and and look
see
under
it.
The.
And see it. Yeah. You know. And it's not some administrator in D.C. You know, it's a person who's driving someone to chemo.
Yeah.
That's what's happening. So, you know, going local, I think, with your charity is a good idea. On the other hand, will we get anywhere on some of these bigger issues if we don't change the Congress? And you don't change the Congress is going to change because generationally it's coming.
Yeah. But how?
And I've said to you a couple of times, you know, the Senate's going to change in our lifetime, Driftglass.
Yep.
Because no Democrat is going to win a primary who isn't in favor of reform of the Senate. And that's just the way it is.
Well,
you know, reforming the filibuster, everyone knows the Senate is broken.
Yes. Yes, they do. And,
so,
and eventually, one day after there's
scales
too much,
will tip.
One day, after there's too much carbon in the atmosphere anyway,
yeah,
we'll decide
that's the thing. I mean, there is that too.
Well, and it's in a certain sense, it's smoker's logic.
Yeah.
It's
I'm gonna
the logic
die anyway.
Of, what?
I'm gonna die anyway.
Well, you start off with it's not that bad. I can, you know, plenty of scientists disagree, plenty of people disagree, and then it's a few people disagree, and then it's well, you know, this is about my freedom, and then it's like, oh, I have cancer. Well, I'm gonna die anyway, so fuck it. I'm gonna keep smoking. At no point in that process did you ever stop and consider that maybe the other guy's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's you're holding off and holding off and holding off and delaying what should be a fairly obvious decision. Until it's already too late. And then you can shrug your shoulders and say, well, there's nothing I could do. There's nothing I could do. Now, the problem we face is that almost every progressive I know or liberal I know cares about a lot of different issues.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you end up making these very strange alliances and letting people do things that you wouldn't ordinarily like them to do or trading. Or holding your nose, all of which makes people cynical and exhausted. I don't want to have to put up one more fucking word out of Joe Lieberman's pie hole.
Yep.
And let's get rid of Lieberman. And then the entire party goes over and gives him a big hug.
Yeah. Yeah.
However, can I read you two paragraphs from Ta-Nehisi Coates?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Wonderful. He almost, as you know, he writes better than everybody. And he is apparently, even as we speak, winging his way or has already landed in Europe, possibly France, on a trip. But on his way there, he apparently had an encounter with a nut, an actual peanut or other
thing.
Kind of, and had a near-fatal allergic reaction.
Wow. Yeah.
And
he almost died. I mean,
he almost died.
My understanding, it was very, very
bad. And by some miracle, the guy sitting behind him had an EpiPen and there was a doctor and they stopped the train. And he went through all the things you go through when you have these things like, oh, you know, maybe this isn't so bad. And maybe I can just sort of bull my way through this. And then suddenly he's on his back screaming for help. And I jotted this down because this is what. I get up on my high horse a lot and bitch about centrism, fake centrism, a lot.
Yeah.
That's sort of one of my things. And I have a whole long definition of what fake centrism looks like. But there is a real moderation, a real centrism that he captures really elegantly here that I think is not hypocritical. It's more a matter of what a tortured conscience looks like when you're trying to find your way through the world. And he said after – these people saved his life. The world has changed. It has not changed totally, but it has changed significantly. When I fell out on the train, everyone on the car was white. So were all the paramedics as well as all the doctors and nurses. The challenge for someone trying to assess America at this moment is properly calibrating how far we've gone with how far we have to go. Too much optimism renders you naive. Too much pessimism makes you cynical. Je ne sais quoi. What I know is I live in a time that people who made me possible only dreamed of. And then yesterday I almost lost it all.
Yeah.
It's really hard. That is not fake reflex both sides do-itism.
No,
it is
no.
a recognition that some things are better. Some things are not yet where they should be. Some things are rolling backwards.
Yeah.
And if you're on the side of people who say the only thing you need to do is get rid of the government and then all those lazy, shiftless welfare cheats will something, something Jeffersonian democracy, then your life is very easy because all you have to do is oppose everything.
Yeah.
And if you are a pessimist who sees nothing but horrible, compromising awfulness in everyone who doesn't agree with you 100% down the road. Everyone who is not pure is a sinner.
Mm-hmm.
It deserves the back of your hand no matter how – they could be with you on 80% of everything. But if they're not with you 100%, then they're traitors and they deserve nothing but your contempt. Then your life is easy.
Yeah.
All you
yeah.
have to do is sit on the sidelines and take pot shots at everything that moves.
Well, and that's the birth of the blogosphere too.
Yeah.
I mean, the birth of the blogosphere, as I've said many times, is – fuck you, George Bush. And it was easy. You didn't have to think beyond that, really. And you could have 100 comments at your blog saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, you're awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's harder.
It's harder. It's work. And, you know, the bloggers, Blue Gal, we are lazy people. We are lazy. We don't like to think too much. We like to have, you know, a pronoun, an adjective, and a link to someone else's work, because that's what aggregators do. But if you are engaged in the business of every day getting up and trying to figure out what the proper balance is, it was easy during the Bush administration because really, point to anything. Point to anything. And it was a fucking disaster. Yeah. Now life is more complicated.
Yeah. And there are still fucking disasters. Believe me.
There's still deep moral, ethical betrayals on the part of our government.
Yes,
we still get stabbed in the back by the guy in the White House, even though that guy is now named Barack Obama.
Yep.
That does happen.
Yep.
And you know what? Obamacare is a horrible compromise.
Yeah.
That is imperfect in lots of ways that have infuriated us. It is, however, better than nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people who line up now to repeal Obamacare and have voted for it now 33 times or whatever the hell it is.
To the point where it is a joke. I mean, it is a late night joke now. Yeah.
They're very clear about what their agenda is. Get rid of everything.
Yeah.
And if you are of the coalition of people who think everything is awful and everyone in power is evil, except for the one good guy who no one ever listens to, then you should be with those people.
Mm-hmm.
You should be standing with Michelle Bachmann, because Michelle Bachmann and you have the same belief that everything in government is equally corrupt all the way across the board. There are no issues. There's no differentiation between anyone and anyone else, as long as you are not 100% on my side.
Well, I think there is that old line from Course in Miracles, which I've read.
Of course you have.
About there being two emotions in the world, fear and love, and everything else is simply an outgrowth of that. And if you are afraid all the time that someone's going to take away that pure good that you have, whether you base that on fundamentalist Christianity, the Bible, or on vegan. I was thinking about that yesterday, by the way. We got a wonderful email from someone a few months ago about eating meat and making some really good arguments about going as meatless as you can because it's better for the environment. And I really enjoyed reading his email and hearing about it, that, you know, factory farms and so forth. He made a really, it wasn't preachy. It was really, this is environmentally speaking, going vegetarian is a very good thing to do for the environment if you can do it. And he was not being nasty about it. You know,
it is the amount of feed required to create
a hamburger. Meat, yeah. It's just bad. Absurd. It's bad for you. So anyway, but I am the only churchgoer in my immediate family. My parents don't go to church. My two sisters don't go to church, and they're all agnostic atheist types and so forth and so on. And I've never, because it's against my belief system, I have never tried to convert anybody to Christianity. I don't believe in doing that. I think that's up to God to do. I think God loves atheists best. I really do. That, you know, God, atheists don't have the crutch of religion to be good and merciful to their enemies and love their children and so forth. They don't have that crutch, so they're good on their own. That's something that I think a mother God would love to have happen. Wow, she grew up and she didn't need me anymore. But so I don't try to convert anyone, even in my own family. I don't discuss religion. I don't tell people they ought to read the Bible. I don't give them tracts and so forth. On the other hand, my two sisters are both PETA vegetarians. And let me tell you, getting together with them, and, you know, I have a brochure for you that you need to read.
It'll change your life.
It'll change your life.
It will.
And it might as well be a copy of Awake from the door-to-door Jehovah Witnesses. You know, it's like, you need to read this.
Yeah.
and you need to be saved. And if you don't do this, you're going to hell, and you're going, you know, you're an evil person. And really, you need to learn it. All this, you know, it's evangelism. That's what it is.
Uh-huh.
And so the reason I bring that up is related to this whole thing of fear and love. If you're so afraid that if you step out of the ring, of everything that's right, that somehow you're condemned. Or if you condemn everybody that's outside of that wagon, you know, you've circled the wagons and anybody who's outside is an enemy. You're living by fear. And if you just sit, if you can live by love and say, look, we're going to get there, have a little bit of confidence, have a little, I think it's what Ta-Nehisi Coates was saying about optimism, you know, and not to be too much of a Pollyanna about it, but have a little bit of optimism in the future.
Well, it's hard to do.
It is.
Because
it's very hard to do when you're being stabbed in the back. It's very hard to do.
I believe the lyric you're looking for is what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding.
Yeah.
It's hard. It is hard. I will say this from a guy point of view. Sometimes it's really hard to be in favor of peace and love.
Yeah.
Because those are such weakling lady emotions. Except, of course, they're not. Yeah. They're incredibly powerful, strong, uplifting, redeeming things. But you don't hear a lot of people talking about love in political life. Yeah. You don't hear a lot of people talking about kindness and humanity and those things because it's scary. Mm-hmm. I remember a friend of mine from years and years and years ago named John, who has since disappeared from my life. But he just – I remember very distinctly having a conversation or a series of conversations with him about sort of historical figures.
Mm-hmm.
And his shtick at the time was – well, George Washington was a pretty good guy, don't you think? He was an adulterate, syphilitic slave owner. Okay. What about Abraham Lincoln? Abraham Lincoln was a fucking compromiser who would have been happy to ship slaves back to blacks back to Africa. Fuck him. And he stole and habeas corpus. But what about like Martin Luther King? Oh, he was an adulterer, you know? And really,
nobody was good enough for him.
Nobody was good enough. Yeah. Everybody was – and It had a lot more to do with, you know, and there's nothing you cannot disagree that George Washington kept slaves. But it was like, yeah, but maybe he did some other stuff. Yeah, well, you're just fucking compromiser. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what you would say. Mm-hmm. You're some poly. And he was so afraid of being a Pollyannish pussy.
Uh-huh.
That he adopted this completely hard ass attitude that basically there's been no one in human history who's worth a shit. And anybody who thinks otherwise is obviously a moron. And that's a really easy posture to take because you can find fault with everybody.
Yep.
And I just finally got sick of it. I just, you know, it didn't matter what the subject – it literally didn't matter what the subject was. He was always going to find something to bitch about.
Yep.
And at some point I just said, you know, I'm going to wait 20 years until there's a thing called the blogosphere. Where I can do this in my pajamas with coffee in my hand and not worry about – you know, getting your finger physically in my face over my suggestion that maybe one position is marginally better than another. Now they all suck. Everything sucks.
Well, and there are a lot of people out there. You know, I'm not trying to say lots of Dems. All right. I'm really not trying to say.
No, that. No. Don't say, for God's sakes, don't say that.
Don't say lots of Dems. No, there is a type of person. And my ex-mother-in-law was one of them. Who didn't think that she sounded intelligent unless she was complaining.
Yeah.
And that people wouldn't listen to her unless she was being critical in some way of what was around her. You know, that's how everyone would recognize that she was a thinker because right. She was being serious and looking at things critically.
Uh-huh.
But no, she was just being negative. All the time.
What was that article from? Was it the New Yorker that, or was it Spy magazine that you used to tell me about? The guy who gets mad at so and so at parties.
Oh no, that was Harvard Lampoon Big Book of College Life.
Yeah.
The guy that you wanted to be known as the guy who hated Keats rather than the guy who drank too much.
Right.
If anybody mentioned Keats, you would throw your drink at the wall and say, "Oh please, Keats, you call him a poet."
Oh, he's that.
Let's reread some of his so-called verse. And then you would be known around campus. Help you get laid because you would be that serious, serious guy. And, you know, then you could knock on some girl's dorm room later on that night and go, "I'm just really upset about Keats. I don't think I should be alone tonight."
Oh, come in. Come in. He was troubled. He was troubled and he was upset about those things. And I
talked a lot about poetry.
I comforted him. He just stared at the ceiling until 2 a.m. And then we did it like rabbits. Yeah.
Yeah.
But there is that. I mean, it is a very simple posture to adopt. And I'm not saying that lots of people who believe what I don't believe or disagree with me aren't sincere. I'm sure they are.
Oh, and I'm not being dismissive of people who genuinely feel, you know, that the XL pipeline is my line in the sand.
Yeah.
You know? Or drones are my line in the sand or whatever. That if that's really where you're at, that's where you're at.
Well, and it has been – I will – it lied over this very lightly. It has been to me, it's really hard to insult me. Don't insult my wife. Don't insult my stepkids. Talk about God all you want. God, you know, my God's big enough to take any joke at all. You know, you can't really insult me that way. But it has been fascinating and in a way amusing in a weird way to watch. On my blog this week for the last week or week and a half.
You're going to talk about the Glenn Greenwald Rorschach test?
in a sense, I don't want to get into any of the issues, but I was pretty careful not to say substantively here are, you know, because you and I have said many times we should get rid of the authorization for military force.
Absolutely.
To regulate drones. We agree. What I disagree with is the absolute over-the-top ad hominem attacks against anyone who suggests there's anything to discuss at all. Yeah. And that is specifically and clearly my objection. And I'm going to frame the debate so that any position other than mine is completely illegitimate. And I've said that repeatedly in lots of different ways. And watching people swing into action and go, you see, why are you attacking poor Glenn? Why are you defending the atrocious behavior of Hitler? Mm-hmm. I'm like, what? Could you be more of a joke? Yeah. That is exactly the point I was trying to make, is that I'm not defending any particular thing. I'm agreeing with you. What I'm really pissed about is the concept that anyone who disagrees with you is illegitimate. And they keep proving my point for me and not even realizing they're doing it. And the thing that cracked me up is it's the Susquehanna Hat Company.
Oh, tell that story. You told me that yesterday.
It's a Abbott and Costello routine where they're asked by a friend of theirs to take a bag of straw hats down to Bagel Street. And to deliver them to someplace because they're going on vacation. They're two men going on vacation. Nothing wrong with that. And since this is on your way, and what kind of hats are these? Oh, these are Susquehanna hats, and they're very nice hats. How much are they? They're $7.50. Wow, that's a very expensive hat. So they walk off down the street, and they go, well, where is Bagel Street? Oh, just ask anybody. Just ask anyone. Everyone knows where Bagel Street is. And the first person they ask, they walk up and Lou is wearing a fine boater hat because he wants to see what a $7.50 hat looks like on his head. And the first guy they encounter, they say, could you tell me where Bagel Street is? Bagel Street? How dare you ask me about Bagel Street? Why don't you know that why are you insulting my intelligence? Bagel Street? I lived on Bagel Street. I was born on Bagel Street. My brother was born on Bagel Street. Are you trying to insult my brother? Are you saying my brother doesn't deserve parole? And Abbott's like, no, I'm just asking the question. Do you know one guy to another? Do you know? And go ahead and insult my brother again. What the hell are you even going down there for? Well, we're trying to deliver hats. Are those Susquehanna hats? Why, yes, they are. Don't you know Susquehanna used as child labor? My God, what sort of monster are you? Tears the hat off his head, rips it to pieces, throws it in his face, and storms off. Next person they encounter. Bagel Street? My husband was killed on Bagel Street. Why are you torturing me by telling me about Bagel Street? Is that a Susquehanna hat you're wearing? If he'd been wearing a better hat, he was wearing one of those cheap Susquehanna hats. If you were wearing a better hat, then that piano that fell 15 stories and killed him wouldn't have killed him. You bastard! And tears up the... And they're just...
And they wind up with no hats at the end.
They wind up with no hats.
Everybody is triggered by Susquehanna Hat Bagel Street.
Bagel Street. And it's that kind of and that's what it and really and truly, that's what it sounds like from my end. Mm-hmm. Is that I'm simply making a point about the way you frame a debate. And the response is, how dare you side with that baby killing monster, you son of a bitch. And it doesn't matter how many times I explain it. It doesn't matter how many times I reframe it. They can't see that that's what they're doing.
Can't take yes for an answer.
And they can't see that maybe standing up in my grill screaming, and a racist, by the way, I discovered I was a racist too, because the only reason lots of Dems don't care about these terrible atrocities is because they're not Muslims.
Oh.
So, you know, okay, that's another way of insulting me. So that's great. And you're finding all these wonderful ways to insult me and denigrate me, and not me personally, but anyone who disagrees with you. And you wonder why people think you're an asshole. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a position. Again, that's a position that's very easy to take. You just blast away at anybody who doesn't line up with you perfectly 100%. And I think it's one way to go through the world. But if you don't mind me reading a quote from, as our last bit.
Yeah.
From Memento. I think what we need to do is heal. Yeah. You know, it's not a very political thing to say. Maybe you can't really vote for it. You can't filibuster it. But watch.
Well, we need to heal with an acknowledgement of the past, is what you're suggesting.
Exactly. There's this really creepy thing going on in conservatism that everyone who listens to us and everybody who reads the blogs can see and has been watching for the last 10 years is an hour by hour denial of what has gone on over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. That Iraq was not a mistake, that Iraq was a noble effort, that Iraq was a noble war. And I swear to you, Blue Gal, in 2, 3, 4, 5 years, the Republican myth is going to be that we could have won in Iraq if we hadn't been betrayed by the liberals.
By the hippies, yeah.
Control the media.
And we have to go back to back to Iraq and fight the war right this time.
And they're and you see them building that mythology right in front of your eyes.
Yep.
And very good, you know, liberals and a few liberals on television are indignant by this. The documentary Hubris is on the air today. Bill Moyers has a wonderful documentary about it. There's a wonderful piece up at my blog. I got it from someplace else. I forget where. That shows Chris Matthews beating up on Phil Donahue.
Yeah.
For opposing George Bush. And Chris Matthews, who helped get Phil Donahue fired for being not loyal enough to America. And this whole idea that we're just going to pretend all that never happened. Mm-hmm. And you can't heal if you don't acknowledge it. And there's this wonderful quote from Memento from Leonard, who can't form new memories, who has no ability to form short-term memories or long-term memories, saying, I know I can't have her back, but I don't want to wake up in the morning thinking she's still here. I lie here not knowing. How long have I been alone? So how can I heal? How am I supposed to heal if I can't feel time? Mm-hmm. And if you can't acknowledge the past as it really happened, if you're so terrified of looking at what you really said, what you really did, what really happened, mm-hmm. if you keep putting Paul Wolfowitz on television and pretending that he's still legitimate, if you keep putting these – if you keep thinking that Dick Cheney has anything to say about anything, if you keep defending it, or if you keep in your mea culpa saying, yeah, but everybody was wrong, but everybody got it wrong, but everybody's to blame. It's that wasn't really me. It was circumstances. It was this. Well, that might partially be true. But if you keep pretending that you never said that 47% of America are welfare moochers, if you keep pretending, if you're Newt Gingrich and you go on Meet the Press one day and say one thing, and the next day you say, anybody who quotes me from Meet the Press yesterday is lying. If that person keeps being legitimized by being put back in the public square by people like David Gregory, we are never going to heal from this. We're never going to get over this, because people are being allowed to create a completely fictional past. David Brooks, again, bending my Lenten promise a little bit, is engaged in a long-term project to completely rewrite the last 50 years.
Well, and his approach this week is that Iraq didn't happen because I'm not writing about it.
I'm not going to write about it. I'm not going to mention it. It never happened. And he wrote lots of terrible things and lots of things that are still in print that nobody mentions to him. And I'm not saying that you should burn in hell forever for that, although I'm really tempted to. What I'm saying is we cannot recover from this catastrophe unless we acknowledge it was a catastrophe, and unless we acknowledge it was a man-made catastrophe made by certain people. Mm-hmm. And that is something that our
Who benefited financially from it.
Benefited financially, also. Ideologically, who got their yah-yahs.
And are still benefiting financially by being put on these shows. Yep.
And as long as we can't say that in public, then we're never going to get over this. Because if you let them get away with it, if you let the liars get away with it, if you let the lies become a legend that they all believe in, then we're going to fight another.
It's going to happen again and again and again. With Iran-Contra and Watergate and Vietnam and on and on. Yeah. We have to end there.
Okay. Good place to end.
Yeah. Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is named Sasha, also known as the Queen. Siamese. Any questions? No. That pretty much sums it up. She's very royal, and we are glad to have her as this week's Internet Kitty at our Facebook and website. You can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Union letter on the air, unless you say otherwise.
So, Blue Gal, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
The Internet Kitties are so relieved that they don't have to gay marry Saxby Chambliss.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Think John Cusack in High Fidelity.
Okay, here we go.
I'm that man now.
Here we go. Uh-huh. We got a letter from Mark, and Mark says, I am a night shift worker who gets off around sunrise, goes home to the garage man cave, and listens to podcasts while drinking a beer and playing solitaire on the Kindle. I am also a 51-year-old sci-fi aficionado. Hey, welcome to the club. Whenever Driftglass brings it up, I drink with gusto. Right now, I'm too drunk to try to stump him, but I have a suggestion for his reading list, The Mad Scientist's Guide to World Domination.
Okay.
Edited by John Joseph Adams and available on the Kindle. It's a collection of often hilarious short stories written from the viewpoint of our beloved villains. Ah, well, that sounds very interesting.
Cool.
By the way, I'm shocked that our President Tuvok Obama, the logical choice, got Star Trek and Star Wars mixed together.
Uh-huh.
Keep up the good fight, Guy Fleegman. P.S. Can Driftglass tell where my screen name Guy Fleegman comes from?
No, I can't.
Answer is the best Star Trek movie ever made, Galaxy Quest.
Ah!
Okay.
Well, okay, I have a personal grudge against Galaxy Quest.
Why?
Galaxy Quest beat The Matrix.
Oh, yes.
The Hugo Award.
Yep.
That was in Chicago. I was at that World Science Fiction Convention. We went out.
Everybody
that night.
Take a drink.
Everybody take several drinks. We went out to go see The Matrix on the IMAX theater at Navy Pier.
Oh, my God. That must have been fun.
They couldn't quite push enough light through it to get it perfectly illuminated. It's a pretty dark movie anyway. But the idea that these stodgy old men would vote for Galaxy Quest over The Matrix has blocked all memory of the basic characters, although I can probably do the plot from memory, from my mind. So I cop to psychic trauma. And,
all right, we got one from Larry. We only have three this week, but okay. We have one from Larry.
Hey, Larry.
My question for Driftglass.
Yeah.
What were at least two pen names used by Alice Bradley Sheldon?
Ah. Alice B. Sheldon. I can give you one and a half.
Okay.
One of them is James Tiptree Jr. And one of them
you've told me about James
Tiptree.
Tiptree Jr. before. Yeah. Isn't that the one where everybody was glad there was a male writer in science fiction finally?
Yeah. This is when basically they started letting women into the field. For a long time it was a completely chauvinist, male dominated juvenilia.
And Ursula K. Le Guin came on the scene and a couple of others, and it was women writing. Yeah.
And there were all these amazing women writers showing up only because they've been denied entry for so long. And there was some apparently despair among the older, whiter, more stodgy engineer types who thought that the ladies were coming to take their toys away from them. And they found some solace in the fact there was at least one muscular male writer out there who was challenging these upstarts. And his name was James Tiptree Jr., who it turned out was a
lady. Alice B. Sheldon.
Yeah.
And who was that chick?
I believe another one of her pseudonyms was Racuna something or other. But I can't remember the details. But I think those were – I think I get credit for 1.5.
1.5. All right. And the last one is from our friend Ten Grain.
Oh, hey, Ten Grain.
Ten Grain says, I'm sleepless, so I was thinking about Stump the Chump. So here's a three-part question.
Shit. All right.
Number one, what is the odd man hypothesis?
Okay.
Number two, is it real? Within the framework of the book, is it real?
Uh-huh.
And number three, in what novel does it appear? You can answer those in any order. What novel is the odd man hypothesis in?
I can do one and three, but I can't do two.
Okay.
The odd man hypothesis is that you get the single guy without a family, without attachments, to be in charge of the self-destruct button. Because he's the one who has the fewest sort of he's the one least willing to think about personal considerations if something needs to be destroyed.
All right. So the way Ten Grain put that is an unmarried male should carry out command decisions during thermonuclear destruct contacts. So, yes. All right.
Okay. Number three, that was in The Andromeda Strain.
Right.
Which is a very good a movie. It's a little bit overlooked these days, but I think it was during the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And a really terrific science fiction, a tense science fiction thriller.
Mm-hmm.
I can't answer number two. I'm guessing maybe yes, but I will confess I never read the novel.
Okay.
I only know the movie, and I don't remember in the movie what the deal was. I remember that one of the characters had epilepsy, and that was why they missed the no growth slide on the slideshow that showed what would actually kill the Andromeda virus and a bunch of other weird little details like that. But I don't know. I don't know the answer to the second.
Ten Grain says the odd man hypothesis was not real. And in the novel, it was an elaborate fiction used by a think tank, the Rand Corporation, to trick the U.S. military into turning over a nuclear weapon to private individuals, in other words, unmarried males in the wildfire team.
Right.
Dr. Hall's copy of the briefing did not contain the Rand study with the hypothesis. Dr. Hall is the one given the key to shut down the bomb, so he has to believe the study is true in order to succeed. So thank you very much, Ten Grain.
Way to go.
Dumped him on the Andromeda Strain, whether that odd man hypothesis is real or not, within the context of the novel.
And that was Michael Crichton, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Back
so
before he lost
there
his
you go.
Yeah.
You can send your Stump the Chump science fiction questions, and you have basically nothing after what, 1985.
I will take shots at anything.
Okay.
Up until current time, but I really stopped reading novelized large form science fiction with the exception of William Gibson, Neal Stephenson, a little bit of Neil Gaiman, and a few others. Around the late 80s or early 90s, I just had it. This is the field that played itself out from my point of view. Movies, however, I'll go all the way up to current time, and even TV shows I'll take a crack at.
Are you looking forward to that new Defiance show?
No.
Mixed in with
really.
A video game. It makes me a little nervous that there's also a video game being played at the same time that the show's going on, and that's supposedly part of the plot of the movie is what happens at the video game. I don't quite understand how they're doing this, but the two are linked in some way. It's not just a spinoff from the show. The video game actually impacts the show in some way. So
if you want to excite me, tell me that someone's making Rendezvous with Rama. That will get my
That'll get your ears, those Vulcan ears perking up.
Yeah. Well, I heard that the rights have been purchased. I forget by who, by Morgan Freeman maybe, or something like that. Years ago, and it's lots of
things get put in a pile.
Yeah,
yeah.
But if you're making a movie out of something, you could do a lot worse than Rendezvous with Rama.
Okay.
Fine story.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure, baby.
Bye.